Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
This variant is insubordinate, stubborn, unpredictable.
You need the God of Mischief.
Unbelievable. Wherever you go, it's just death, destruction, the literal ends of worlds.
Okay.
Change.
To mix it up. Is that possible? You can change?
I am Loki, and I am burdened with glorious purpose.
Change?
Hello, and welcome to Still Watching Loki, Episode 5. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson, and I'm here all by my lonesome at the beginning of the episode to talk to you about how this week's episode of the podcast is going to be a little different. First of all, our pal, Richard Lawson, who usually co-hosts this podcast with me, has been pruned from the timeline for the rest of the season. He is off at the Cannes Film Festival in France. So unfortunately, we lost our beloved Richard. We will miss him dearly. But we've got a couple guest hosts this week, and as well as Anthony Bresnikan, who will be here at the end of the show to answer some of your questions. I think we're going to just do mostly like a mailbag segment at the end of the show. So here's how it's going to work this week. If you're just joining us for the first time, Still Watching is a show where we watch a show obsessively, break it down week by week. This week, we will be talking about Loki Episode 5. Titled Journey into Mystery, and it was written by Tom Kaufman, another Rick and Morty alum, and directed by Kate Herron. Here are how the segments are going to go. The first section is going to be my pal Mark Bernardin, who is a fantastic podcaster, TV writer, comics writer, you know, just nerd about town. Great, great, smart guy here to talk to me about Loki as a TV show with a little bit of comic book element to it as well. Then in the middle segment of the show, we've got Daniel Kibblesmith, who is a fantastic, also a TV writer, also a comic writer. And he wrote a great run of the Loki comic in 2019 that I really liked. So I wanted to get his perspective as someone who's written the Loki character and written him really well to answer the question of, you know, what makes a Loki a Loki? And then rounding out the show, of course, as I said, Anthony Bresnikan will be here. We'll be answering a lot of your questions that you sent into stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. So that's the show today. I think it's gonna be really fun. So let's start off with the great Mark Bernardin, TV writer guy, occasional comic book writer guy. Let's hear from Mark. Hello, Mark. How are you today?
I am so good, Joanna. It's lovely, lovely to be here in wherever here is. The void.
The perhaps, void, I mayhaps, guess. Yes. we got you for a morning call on a bright and early on a Wednesday morning to talk about Loki, episode 5, Journey into Mystery. I am so happy to have you here because you have multiple expertise intersecting on something like this. But I want to tap your brain first as someone who has worked in television for a little while now. I just want to ask you sort of overall how you feel Loki is working as television.
It's always hard to quantify that, given that, you know, Marvel has, it's a different game that they play compared to other TV, which is they know we're going to watch. Unlike almost every other TV show on the planet, you know, if you're launching a first season, you're just praying people show up. You're just like, please, fingers crossed. I know we're doing this show about this thing and we think you'll like it. They're spending all the money in marketing, but we don't know if it's going to bring the eyeballs.
Yeah.
Marvel has this, like, they're at the top of a mountain where they can look down and just say, we know they're going to watch this. Now, how do we make the experience what we'd like it to be? And how do we, you know, try and figure out ways to please an audience who we know we're going to come to taste the cake? And is it incumbent upon us to make this cake interesting, or can it just be cake? And I think that you know, they have succeeded on various degrees in that in various Marvel shows. You know, to the point where I just keep wondering, like, this isn't playing by the rules of TV that I know it, because if this was the first episode of any other TV show, I would not watch the second episode of this show. Mm-hmm. Because it's not giving me anything to hook into. Aside from, here are shiny movie stars doing shiny movie star things, right, on my small screen.
Right.
You know, I think Loki started off a little bit better than some of the other shows have, because the conceit of the TVA is interesting and the production design is so smart, and, you know, Tom Hiddleston doing Hiddles things and Owen Wilson doing Wilson things, you know, is sort of enough to sort of like hand wave any kind of plot. I'm not even gonna say laziness, I'm gonna say sluggishness. Mm-hmm. In that it doesn't quite engage with what do these characters want, what is their quest, what are the stakes, you know, like all of those questions that you have to answer if you're just creating a new show out of thin air, which is what's driving Michael Knight every week? Well, he's a lone crusader out for truth and justice on the high roads of whatever. And he's got a talking car. Like, you understand it in the opening title, right, what the show's about.
Sure.
Whereas, you know, Loki has taken about 5 episodes for me to really key into, like, okay, what's this enterprise? You know, oh, I get it. Lokis are Lokis, and they've never been, you know, they've always been solitary. They've always been, you know, gods of, I mean, less mischief, because mischief sounds like it could be fun, and these guys never seem like they're having fun. But like, they're solitary creatures, and this is the Loki meeting another Loki for the first time, who decide they want to be friends or more than friends. And is that creepy? Because, like, they're the same thing, uh-huh, but a little different. Uh-huh. And is it incest? Is it masturbation? I don't understand, but okay. It seems sweet. Are we friends? Great. You know, and so by the time you get to Journey into Mystery, mm-hmm, I feel like it's engaging with what it's kind of supposed to be, or was maybe always about, but just never brought to the surface, which was, can a Loki find a partner?
And can a Loki change?
And can a Loki change?
It spots. Yeah, yeah. I think that's interesting. The word you use is sluggish. Is something that I, you know, that was tossed around with some of my other TV critic friends when we got the screeners, where I was like, I like this, but I see what you mean in terms of Marvel has the luxury of a really slow burn if they want to, because they know they're not going to lose people the same way another show might fear that they would lose people, right? Because...
Yeah, like Marvel at this point is the prettiest person in high school, you know? And it's like, do I have to work that hard to do stuff? I'm like this sad nerd who's just trying his best in the corner to like build a community and find some friends. But like, well, no, dude, you're on the football team and you're also a, you know, a Rhodes Scholar, and you're like, you're Will Smith and everybody else is Carlton. And it's like,
and everyone else is dancing sweatily for your attention.
Dancing sweatily for your attention and pratfalling and hoping that you'll really, really like him.
Yeah.
Well, meanwhile, you're just sitting there in the corner kind of dancing like a fool, but you're beautiful and funny and handsome and everybody knows it.
Uh-huh. Amazing. this is an episode. I don't always love when the sky is raining Easter eggs. It can feel so unorganic, but this episode, the premise is very friendly to that. So I wasn't mad about it at all. I don't know if you were, but I was wondering if there were any particular Easter eggs that you enjoyed, especially in this episode.
Well, I'll tell you, there's one that I totally didn't spot. I noticed that there was a helicopter grounded that had a big Thanos mm-hmm. on the side of its fuselage, mm-hmm. which I was like, that's weird, but okay. And it wasn't until, you know, I sort of poked around the internet. I was like, I don't know. There was absolutely a you know, issue of, I want to say it's like Spider-Man or something, where Thanos is flying a helicopter that has Thanos on the side of it.
Amazing. Yeah, there were a bunch of villain vehicles in this episode, but the Thanos copter has to be my favorite for sure.
The Thanos copter is fantastic. You know, and like the sort of the downed helicarrier kind of in the corner there. It's like, oh, that was always a bad idea. Helicarriers.
They really were. They really were. They See, never stay
at
up.
The end of the world. Nope.
Never stay up, always come down. I'm a big fan personally of Frog Thor. Because, for folks who don't know, Frog Thor is definitely something that exists in the comics. you can call him Throg if you want. But anyway, yeah, there's just like a quick shot of him in a little jar as the camera pans down through soil. There's also a bunch of cafeteria trays in that shot. And I don't know if like people at the TVA just like prune their cafeteria trays because they don't want to wash them. Like, I don't know what they're doing there, but yeah,
that's how you bust a table. Yeah. In TVA. You just fling it into the void.
Just prune it. Fine. the only other thing that I have like major questions about, I mean, there's such a bunch of things and folks can look up all the Easter eggs if they want to, but there's a yellow jacket helmet, this large version of the helmet that I suppose Corey Stahl wore in Ant-Man. And that the only reason that is super interesting to me is because there's a theory going around that all of the TVA stuff is taking place in the quantum realm because it's a place out of time. And so I don't know if that's an indication of something to come, but I do know that Corey Stahl in some shape will be back for Ant-Man 3. So I don't know if they're dropping a little.
Well, I mean, it does sort of make sense given that, you know, Eliath was a bad guy who like took over Kang's like city planet thing at some point. And we know that Kang is going to be in Quantumania.
Right.
And so the Ant-Man through line, oddly enough, seems to be kind of clear, which is, you know, we're beginning that story with Kang, Quantum Realm, Ant-Man, Yellowjacket. Like, okay, sure.
Sure.
That could work.
We're going to talk a little bit more about Eliath and Kang. For those who are unfamiliar and confused, we will talk a little bit more about that in a second. But my last Easter egg question for you is, was there anything not comic book, but like TV or film or otherwise that you saw in the episode that you're like, oh, huh, they're doing that?
You know, I think that one of the things that kind of bothered me a little bit about episode 4, mm-hmm. Which, you know, felt like it was like the Defiant Ones meets Midnight Run on a planet that's about to explode, was the way it would just kind of like sit down and have Sylvie and Loki just like have a conversation in what felt like should be panic mm-hmm. and like urgency and, you know, oh my God, this planet's about to explode. It's like, that's cool. We're just going to have this little walk and talk for like 5 minutes where we explain our feelings and aren't running all the time. But I think that this episode, when you get Sylvie and Loki kind of sitting down having a conversation, because the conversation is now Loki kind of broaching his own self-awareness that he's changed and that this is finally, ultimately what he wants, which is to not be alone and to not betray everybody and to find somebody he loves and who loves him back and then hold to that. Like, you know, it felt earned in a way that the conversations in the last episode didn't. you know, like if you're going to stop everything for this, then it should be the biggest conversation in the world. And it kind of was.
Yeah.
And so like I appreciated that, you know, from a purely like structural point of view of like, oh yes, now's where we just kind of pause for a minute and then let these two characters, you know, profess their love for each other in the weirdest way possible.
I mean, it felt very Night of the Seven Kingdoms, one of my favorite episodes of Game of Thrones, like the night before the battle episode moment, mm-hmm. right? You know, we're going to war. Let's stop and really reckon with what that means for us. Yeah.
Yeah. It's one of those, like, we're going to cauterize all of these emotional threads so that we can launch into the giant plot thread,
mm-hmm.
You know, which definitely has its place. And it's definitely a TV/storytelling/adventure trope. Of, you know, the X-Men would do it all the time, where it's like, hey, we're about to do this giant thing going up against a Hellfire Club, but before we do that, we're going to play some softball, you guys.
Yeah.
And we're gonna like lean into the soap opera of it all before yeah. everything, you know, goes to hell.
All right, this wasn't the order I was going to do things, but since you are so perturbed yet intrigued by Loki Prime and Sylvie, let's go there first. What's the over-under odds that they kiss before the series is over, Mark?
I mean, I feel like if they do, it's the end of all reality.
Right.
Right? Like, right. Maybe there's some, like, Lokis can't kiss. That's weird. Or all of us on this, you know, doomed scroll planet have just been gay the whole time. And so we've just been Loki-ing it up. And so maybe the kiss is not a big deal on a sort of trans-dimensional apocalypse scale. But I kind of don't want them to. You know, like I don't want this to be romance because it doesn't feel like it needs to be. Like I think you just want it to be they found somebody, and that yeah. doesn't need to be, you know, smoochy smoochy time as much as we can hold hands and that's cool because now we're family, #family.
Thank you for that Vin Diesel representation. I think you definitely have that with like Mobius and Loki, right? Like that's the family love story without the smooching. And maybe we won't get any smooching with Loki Prime and Sylvie. But the thing that I wonder is it feels like they're kind of building towards that where Mobius says, I think in episode 4, you know, whatever it was you guys did, which was just touch forearms, was like so explosive. It was just off the chart sort of thing. So like if you guys really get together, you could bring the whole thing down, like a kiss to end the world sort of thing. And which I think is kind of time cop rules a little bit, but but it also goes back to what Loki says in episode 3 when he talks about love being a dagger. Right? Like, love is a dagger. Like, is there love? I mean, this is going to sound so corny, and please don't retch on Mike, but like, love is the ultimate weapon in this story? ? Like, I don't know. I have thoughts about that.
So. I mean, I would honestly love it if the only Loki to change was Loki Prime, and that Sylvie Loki is still playing a Loki game. You know, she is still using Loki Prime to her own ends, which is I want to take down the TVA and I want, you know, I want to see who's, you know, the man behind the mask. And if I have to stab a dude in the chest with love / smooching, then I will.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, there's this question hanging over presumably the finale, which is can Loki Prime change? You know, she's like, you're not going to betray me, are you? And I'm like, I'm not worried for a second that our Loki is going to betray her. But to your point, there's still a possibility that she might betray him. It could happen.
Yes.
Yeah.
Totes.
Yeah. Yeah. This brings me to one of my favorite questions to ask people.
Mark,
what makes a Loki a Loki in your point of, in your point of view?
It seems ironically that what makes Loki a Loki is an inability to look down the road at all, despite the fact that Loki's always talk about like their grand plans and devious machinations. They never look round the corner to see what's going to happen on the other side of it. You know, like for all of our experience with Loki Prime, he just does dumb stuff to do dumb stuff, or he wants a thing to want a thing without ever really reckoning with what it means to have a thing. You know, like, I'm going to betray my brother again and again and again. And what does it mean? And what is it, you know, what am I getting on the other side of this? You know, and so for Loki Prime to begin to understand that, ironically, through interactions with the TVA, that, you know, he could peer a little bit into the future, even if he just gamed it out half a beat, and realize that so many of the things that he does are futile and self-destructive, then he could actually do something with his life.
Yeah.
You know, he could actually be something. And, you know, the god of mischief doesn't necessarily need to always be that. You know, you could be that, just because, like, if Thor is not the god of hammers, then Loki can be the god of other things as well.
I love this. I want to move over to Richard E. Grant's character. Classic Loki, if we want to call him that. Whatever.
Classic Loki.
Classic. His little mini arc in this episode, he says at one point, you know, we're always broken. We can't change. Like, we'll never change. That's just who we are. This is the you know, the hand that fate has dealt us, et cetera. And then we have Mobius at one point saying to him, it's never too late to change. And then he has this rallying thing at the end where instead of running away from the fight, he faces the fight. He stands with the other Loki. So, you know, I like what you were saying earlier about this idea of the story we're watching is this idea of Loki's in isolation and not needing to stay that way. And maybe it was in the TVA's interest to keep these Lokis isolated, because what Richard Grant's character says is that he didn't get pruned when he avoided Thanos's, you know, strangulation grip. He went off by himself for a long time, and he only got pruned when he tried to come back and reunite with Thor. And so it's this like idea of like, it's not that wasn't avoiding death wasn't the issue. It was like connection that was the issue. I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, it's also crazy weird that they've only been pruning Lokis. That there's nobody else on this planet but Lokis. You know, there's not a whole, like, unless we haven't seen the continent of, you know, Thors and, like, Phils from accounting and, you know, Spider-Man and whatever. Like, it's just Lokis. And so what is it about Lokis that if they could work together, if they could, you know, bond and supersede their programming and become more than they are?
Yeah.
What is the TVA so afraid of, and why have they hidden so many of them here? You know, and I also think that to your earlier question, what makes a Loki a Loki? I think there's a whole lot of theatricality and flair to being a Loki. There's a lot of, like, you know, I'm the diva ballerina, and, you know, to the point where, like, every time Loki Prime, like, gets up, there's the hair toss. Like, no matter what he's doing, there's this, like, very theatrical, like, wha! Uh-huh. Look at my hair.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like the ending of Loki, of classic Loki story, also feeds into the theatricality of it. Like, wouldn't it be cool if I was the hero right now?
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be great if I went out like this, as opposed to, you know, living in a bowling alley with an alligator and, you know, a child?
Right.
Like, this is the ending fit for a Loki, and so I'm going to embrace it.
Yeah.
You know. And so I think there's a little bit of the you know, trying to forge a connection, trying to understand that these two people have what I never can. And so if I can help them push that along a little bit, I will. And also, this is the greatest swan song in the history of swan songs. So let me stand here with my baggy boxers and just raise Asgard from the ashes one last time.
It was amazing. It was great. There's also that was an amazing dramatic flourish, but also there's this moment earlier when Loki Prime proposes something and all the Lokis laugh at him, and Richard E. Grant does so by throwing his cape in the air and just like kicking his legs up. And you're just like, he's like, oh, I'm so glad I have a cape, essentially. You know what I mean? It's just sort of like, it's fantastic.
He's like a can-can dancer. Just like, wow.
Yes, exactly. To your point about like, why are there only Lokis here? I mean, we do see that ship drop, and presumably that ship wasn't manned entirely by Lokis. But it gets swallowed right away. And so I think the idea is there are only Lokis here because only Lokis can survive this place. That's something that one of them says, like, we're survivors. We survive.
Yes. That's a better reading than mine was.
Well, no. But I mean, I think it is a good question. Why are there only Lokis there? And it brings me to my favorite theory that I don't know if I've bothered you with yet, but here it is. I have thought and then stopped thinking, but now I'm back to thinking that maybe Mobius is a stealth Loki. What do you think of that sort of thematically?
I think it's interesting, and I think it's totally valid. I have in my head a different stealth Loki, but maybe they could both be stealth Lokis. But I think, in my gut of guts, I'm thinking that Ravona Renslayer is a Loki.
Oh, I love it! I love it. What? Like, when did you start thinking that, and what do you feel like supports that in your heart?
I started thinking it this episode, mm-hmm. And I started thinking it when she starts talking to Miss Minutes, and like when she's playing the game with Sylvie, when she's interviewing Hunter B-13 or 15 or whatever that digit is. Uh-huh. I know it's a teen, and her sort of manic desire to also get to the bottom of who's at the TVA, mm-hmm. you know, or to stop other people from doing so, because she, like the Loki in Thor Ragnarok, has taken over the TVA and has erected a sort of puppet authority, so she can just have it as she wants it. She can run rampant throughout time and space, and there's nobody to stop her. She's found the domain for which she's going to rule, which also feels like the thing that Loki's also want,
right?
Which is, where's my kingdom?
Right.
You know, where's my throne? And Ravona Renslayer has a throne, and she has a kingdom, and she has everybody at her beck and call doing things that apparently only she knows about and knows the secrets of.
Here's why I really like that theory. I think you and I are circling sort of the same drain, which is that it is only going to be satisfying in the show if the reveal of who's behind everything is someone we already know. That it, yeah. You know, like, we'll talk about sort of who comic book fans are convinced is behind everything. But like, in terms of television, compelling, interesting television, it is most interesting if another Loki is behind everything, or at the very least, a character we've already met in Mobius or Ravona is behind everything, right? Like,
the murderer cannot be a brand new person at the end of the episode. You have to have met him in the second act.
Right. That's what I think. And so a million comic book fans would disagree with us right now, but I genuinely think it has to be something that we've seen. It has to be something that's thematically tied to the heart of the show, which is sort of what makes a Loki a Loki? Can a Loki change his spots? All this sort of stuff, you know? And so it makes the most sense for it to be a Loki, or for at least a Loki to be involved in some of it. But
yeah, who are you hearing? Is it Mephisto?
I bet
you.
No, I promise you, it's not Mephisto this time. No, it's. Let's talk about Kang. Mark, who is Kang the Conqueror?
Kang the Conqueror is a sort of like he's a Time Lord ultimately, who just goes. He bounces from timeline to timeline and just conquers things and takes them over, because that's what a Kang does.
Kang gonna Kang, you know?
Kang's gonna Kang.
Yeah, and, we've talked about this a little bit on the show before, mostly sort of in our back half of the show when we get a little nerdier about comic book stuff, but Kang the Conqueror is a character that we know is coming in the upcoming Ant-Man film, played by Jonathan Majors. A lot of people have wondered if he was going to get introduced here. It feels unlikely to me, based on what we've seen from timelines and Disney Plus and all that sort of thing. I think we could get a Kang tease, but I am sort of firmly on it won't feel interesting for non-comic book nerds, and with all love to comic book nerds, for the reveal to be Kang. Because if you're like, dun-dun-dun, it's Kang, like the casual viewer at home is like, it's who now? You know?
Right.
Like, who is it? Right? And there's a lot of clues, like Eliath, this, you know, definitely a ripoff of the Lost Smoke Monster, Guardian that's in this episode, Chronopolis, this like city at the end of time, all this sort of stuff. This is all Kang stuff. Ravona is connected to Kang in the comics. It's all trappings of Kang, which is why comic book folks are convinced it has to be Kang. But I'm just saying, for like in the same reason why it was a bad idea for me to get wound up about it being Mephisto in WandaVision, it's a bad idea to get wound up and it being Kang, I think, because the Disney Plus is trying to play to all crowds at once, right? What do you think?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that, like, Kang is not a satisfying resolution for the viewer.
Right.
Because we have no emotional attachment whatsoever to a Kang. You know, Kang, like, your villain and your hero need to have some connection to one another that has been put on the stage at some point. Otherwise, it's just, that's a dude. Okay, sure. Could Kang be some, like, mid-credits throw into, right, you know, Ant-Man 3? Sure.
Sure, yeah.
But, like, it's the, you know, it's the Avengers thing when, like, oh, you know, Loki's the bad guy, and, you know, sure, there's, you know, some dude up in the sky, but you don't reveal Thanos until the very, 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 very end because it doesn't matter to the main drama that that was Thanos. You know, it's a promise of things to come as opposed to an answer to the things you've seen.
I completely agree. And, yeah.
You know, so to that end, it either has to be, it's somebody we've met before. It's definitely somebody we've met before, whether it's Ravonna, whether it's, you know, Mobius is actually, look, he's been playing this all from the inside, whether it's Miss Minutes, who's some kind of, like, you mm-hmm. know, techno mage creature who built the three mechanical puppets and who's been running it, you know, as the kindly AI the entire time. Sure. We've seen that. We know what that is. We've had your main characters have had interactions with that. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to just sort of pull the mystery box out of thin air and be like, that's your bad guy. Like, who's that?
Exactly. It's just not, it's not emotionally good television, even if it feels like exciting for comic book fans. And I want comic book fans to get excited and get what they want. But I think what you're saying, exactly, like a tease, an end of credits, mid credits tease, could fulfill that prompt while having the big bad be someone, you know, be Agatha all along. Like that's been the vibe of these Disney Plus shows. It's Sharon Carter. It's Agatha all along. It's like someone who's been in plain view the whole time.
I do long, though, for the, at some point, it's the, here was the big bad guy. We know who it is. You know, it's not a surprise.
Right.
It's, you know, like, oh, it's the power broker. Ooh, it's Agatha. It's, no, we set it up. That's the bad guy. We're going to go punch that dude. But that's really hard.
Well, I think also in this era of, like, you know, and I am as guilty as anyone of this, of TV theorizing being a thing that drives audience engagement, you're going to just see mysteries constantly, you know, because it's like that, it's that like Westworld sort of thing where, like, or Mr. Robot or whatever it is. Like if Reddit is buzzing about their theories and everyone can get excited about their theories, that's going to get people more excited to watch the show, you know?
So. I mean, I guess, but there's also the argument that, again, Marvel doesn't need help getting people to watch their shows, which should actually liberate them to do things that don't fall into line with, all right, I'm launching this new series of this thing. I got to get the buzz. Like, you're Marvel. You have the buzz. Like, make my bad guy the Joker, where he's right there.
Yeah.
He's not hiding.
Yeah,
he's
yeah.
not prevaricating. He's not ducking around corners. Like, he's just the Joker. Marvel could do that. And I'm hoping that you know, at some point we'll see that, because the mystery, at some point, not to say we're going to get tired of trying to guess who the bad guy is, or who the real bad guy is, but, like, just change the pitch a little bit, give something different to swing at.
Yeah, I have two thoughts about that. Number one, you're totally right about Marvel TV now. I think there was more insecurity when they first launched the Disney Plus shows. Like, are people going to come along for these rides, especially around WandaVision, which they were worried was, like, a little too avant-garde, etc. And I think you're right that they can have confidence now that people, oh yeah, people are going to show up. You don't have to worry about it. You know what I mean? Like, you got this. So in future season, like, these are the first three things that they developed all in sort of like a lump, but in future iterations that they might be able to do exactly what you're saying. And the other thing, as I was thinking about, I was wondering if maybe this was intentionally thematic, this sort of like villain hiding in plain sight thing. Because we know that they're going to do a Secret Invasion TV show coming up, which is all about, you know, people you've known all along are actually Skrulls. That's what the Secret Invasion is in the comic book. So maybe it's like a thematic, like sort of like how in whatever phase it was, phase two, or whatever, when I was getting their arms chopped off. Like, this is the theme of Disney Plus Marvel TV is the, you know, your friend is actually your enemy.
Right.
Look out.
Your arms off. You're my friend.
Exactly. I want to float something else by you. I'm you know, what seems to go back to your question of like, why are all these Lokis being shoved into the void here, right? I think while it may not be only Lokis that are being pruned, they seem especially fixated on Lokis being pruned. And I think you have to think of it this way in terms of like, what does the TVA accomplish? Whoever's running the TVA, some nefarious figure or whatever, or a Loki, what is their investment in keeping Lokis isolated or not unheroic or whatever it is they need Lokis to be that they keep snipping off these other versions of them? Do you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, I think it's possible that it's, you know, the gods of mischief are unpredictable, and the best way to keep an ordered timeline, you know, on the march is to remove the variables, the variants that make things unpredictable. You know, everything else is somewhat staid and easy and like, oh, I know what that guy's going to do. He's got a big chin. He's going to, you know, lead with it and he's going to get punched and that's fine. You know, or these, you know, bunch of normies are just going to do what normies do. But Lokis, you can, like, there's elements of Lokis that are predictable, which is that they are unpredictably predictable. Mm-hmm. But even still, they're the fly in the ointment that you can't ever really, you know, control. And so if there's a way to remove them from the stage, then it might be easier to plot your temporal domination.
I love that. The other thing that I was thinking about in terms of like trying to figure out like a satisfying, emotionally satisfying motivation for all of this, is I have to go back to the first episode when Mobius is showing Loki, like, you know, this is your life, Loki, footage on the wall of the TVA. And he shows his mom, Frigga's death, the lovely Renee Russo dying. And Mobius says something about, like, it happens over and over and over again. No matter what, this is the outcome. Frigga dies, basically. And so in my head, I was like, other than like world domination, could a motivation for a Loki be trying to find a timeline where he's not responsible for his mom's death? You know what I mean? Like that's a deep wound that they might want to heal for themselves. What do you think?
I mean, totally. You know, yeah. It goes back to, you know, some of the reasons why we invested ourselves so much in the MCU, which is things like Cap, he killed my mom. You know, like the idea that at its core, so many of these stories and so many of these characters are motivated by very sort of basic, and that's not a pejorative, but basic human desires and wants and feelings of like, killed my mom, dude. Like, of course I'm going to punch him in the face a lot. Like, I understand it. Like on a purely academic level, I get it, but he killed my mom. Like, I killed my mom. Is there a world in which I don't do that? And I don't want to have been the person who does that, you know? And like, when confronted with the totality of his, you know, effects, his CV of mischief, like, that's the thing that he would like to have not done.
Yeah.
You know? And so for that to be, you know, it's really, really interesting. I wish that if that was the case, that had been on the stage a little bit more.
Yeah.
You know, if we had hit that note, not like 1,000 more times, but like 2 more times than we have.
It was a sort of idea that I've been holding on to since episode one. But in this episode, Loki says, you know, I betrayed my father. I betrayed my brother. I betrayed, you know, Asgard essentially. And I was like, oh, he didn't mention his mom. Then it probably isn't Frigga. Like they would have circled back to Frigga a couple times if if they were gonna go there. But I'm just trying to find like a reason behind total world domination, which is such a boring motivation for a villain. as to what might be going on here. Do you know what I mean?
I mean, if there's the scene in episode 6 you know, which is called, you know, Mommy, where where you finally get, you know, Loki and Rene Russo is your big surprise drop of like back as Frigga. And then you get that scene, you know, where it's, you know, warm and maternal and lovely. And she says, I'm so glad you're home, Loki. You've got to stop doing things in the universe and just visit your mother every now and again and just get that purely emotional, yeah. You know, Pavlovian, just this is that scene of the thing this boy has wanted ever since he was a boy. Would be lovely and wonderful, you know, and if Sylvie is there and is the engine for that, you know, is also wonderful.
To not be the god of outcasts, to be, you know, the god of being well-domed by your mom. yeah, it's interesting. One of our listeners wrote in and you know how these Disney Plus shows leave the credits card blank when an actor isn't in an episode at the end of the episodes? Mm-hmm. There are two blanks remaining that haven't been used in any of the episodes. And so, Ooh. You know, might it be Rene Russo? Might it be Jonathan Majors? I don't know. Who mm-hmm. else could it be? But yeah, it's kind of interesting.
Yeah. I mean, there's also the world in which, you know, I'm pretty sure Hemsworth was shooting Love and Thunder in time to be able to do some small cameo. At the very tail end of it.
I mean, yeah. I mean, if anyone, give us Thor. But I've sort of enjoyed how kind of little Thor there has been in the show, because Loki is so often defined in contrast to Thor. And so it was interesting to try to define him outside of the context of Thor, define him in the context of other Lokis. Do you know what I mean?
That's been interesting. Yeah. I mean, although I do think that the best Loki scene we've had until this show started was that bit in Ragnarok where, you know, Thor's like, I thought the world of you, yeah. You know, I thought we would just like fight side by side forever,
yeah. You
know, but you're you and I'm me. And thus it ever was. And like that moment of I've known who you were, you know, the entire time and hoped you could be better, but you're not. And so to find the mirror of that scene, which feels like, you know, in Ragnarok, is the scene of evolution for Loki, is a scene of realization for Loki. And so if there's some way to echo that, to harmonize with that, would also be super fun.
Yeah, I'm very satisfying. I'm looking for satisfaction. I'm looking for emotional resonance and satisfaction, Mark. That's all I'm looking
Give
for.
It to me.
Oh, is there anything else you want to say about this episode or about Loki in general?
I was hoping that one of the Lokis that we would see was just like the definition of mischief, like whoopee cushions on chairs, you know, like mischief is always portrayed as this nefarious, somewhat evil thing when referring to Lokis. But where's just the dude who's a prankster? Where's the dude who just fills a paper bag with dog poop and leaves it outside somebody's front door? Like, where's the toilet papering the trees Loki? You know, the mild, low-grade mischief is kind of what I wanted.
Yeah, we get Kid Loki, who's obviously a figure from the comics, and he's, you know, I guess that was an opportunity, you know, it could have been Kid Loki, who was like the most mischievous thing.
But it's also like he kills Thor.
Yeah, and it was like heavy was the head that wears the crown with this was Kid, you know, and he had this sort of like a little controller device that was never explained. I don't know if there was some Kid Loki stuff that was cut or what, but I was just like, what's this device? What does it do? Why are you holding it? I guess it tracks the storm or other things. I don't know.
It's a sonic screwdriver.
yeah, exactly. All right. Well, I think we did it, Mark. Where can, if folks want more of your very insightful, eloquent opinions, where can they find you?
They can find me on the interwebs. I'm at Mark Bernardin, MarkBernardin on both Twitter and Instagram. I do not do the Facebooks, because reasons. Mm-hmm. And every week or so, I hold forth on a podcast with Kevin Smith called Fat Man Beyond, where you will hear my dulcet tones also make very little sense.
No, all the sense in the world. It's a great show. You're fantastic on it. Thank you so much for the chat, Mark. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Always fun, these.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
All right, we got an extra special treat on the show today. We've got someone that I am a massive fan of. He's a comics writer, TV writer. He writes children's books. He's got an upcoming Marvel comic that he cannot talk about it, so don't ask him. It's Daniel Kibble Smith. Hello, Daniel. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me. I love being a special treat.
A delight, a true joy. I have you here, of course, not just because I think you are brilliant and hilarious, but also because you wrote a great run of the Loki comic in 2019. So I thought it might be fun to get your perspective on Loki as a character. In other words, maybe I'll start easy. Hey, what makes a Loki a Loki? In
oh,
your
Lord.
View.
Right, because there's not, like, an entire Disney Plus television show devoted to this question right now.
Right now.
What makes a Loki in my view? That's really interesting. I mean, I think that it's a very... let's go with he for now, is a very layered character. And I think at the core is the myth. Right? And I think as long as you're serving and honoring that origin, it's kind of, everything else is fair game. Because what makes Loki so exciting and malleable to me is that the canon that you have to honor is somebody who is capable of anything. So what makes a Loki, what makes this TV show possible and all of the different permutations in the comics possible, is that you can't really get it wrong as long as you justify why Loki is doing whatever the thing is. And that's usually self-serving. Overwhelmingly self-serving. So I think as long as Loki is acting in his own self-interest, it's a plausible Loki story. Because everything else is on the table. He's a shapeshifter. He's virtually immortal. You know, he kind of lives in outer space sometimes, the way Asgard is occasionally reckoned. It's all on the table. I think the only thing he can't be is Thor.
And why do you say that?
Well, because you need them bouncing off of each other. You need that sort of it's not quite a yin and yang, but it's two people who are foils for each other in a way that has been kind of hammered out. God, there's going to be a lot of accidental puns on this one. they're foils for each other in a way that's sort of been hammered out over thousands of years of storytelling. Like, they are conformed to fit each other. So if it's something that Thor would do, it's probably not something that Loki would do, unless the reason he's doing it is in the context of Thor. Like, being heroic because Thor is absent, or being heroic to show up Thor. You know, that I can see Loki doing.
Someone I know who's smarter than me about the story was sort of making this point that Loki exists as defined in reaction to Thor. That's sort of similar to what you just said. And I'm curious what you make of, you know, you and I have both at this point seen four episodes of the Loki series. We one more will probably drop before anyone hears you talk about this, but like, what do you make of how little Thor there is in the show? Not just like Chris Hemsworth isn't going to do the Disney Plus show, but just sort of from a storytelling point of view, what is it like to spend this time with Loki not in reaction to Thor?
Well, I think it's very necessary if you're going to make a Loki show. They do a really good job. People always ask me, and I'm not, you know, I'm not involved with the television program. I'm a big fan, and I'm excited to talk about it. But people ask me just as somebody who is vocally Loki-fied and a big MCU fan, can this be the first thing that I watch? Do I have to watch 25 movies, or can I just skip to this? And I think they do a pretty good job in the first episode of the Loki show, showing you everything that you need to know in terms of the relationships that informed this version of the character, this 2012, still somewhat villainous, but also, from a story perspective, very much informed by the growth that his other self had for the purposes of the audience. I think they do a really good job creating this kind of blended Loki that is all of the MCU stories while still being kind of this other character, which is one of the tools that I think lets them start from a blank slate and get away from some of that stuff. He doesn't have all of the growth he has from like a Thor Ragnarok. But to answer your question, which I kind of remember what it was. I think that I'm sorry. Could you repeat it? I got off on a total tangent,
and
you can leave this in if you want to show everybody my writing process.
No, just what do you make about how sparingly Thor is mentioned or used, and so what is it like to explore Loki outside of that context of Thor?
Right. I think that it's necessary in order to do a Loki show, because there's a bit of a growing pain whenever you take somebody who's not the expected protagonist and put them in a starring role, especially if it's one of the bad guys. And I think the first story with somebody like Harley Quinn is about breaking away from the Joker. And even in something like the Harley Quinn animated show, the Joker is still very much present. It's mm-hmm. sort of a story about the tortured, gradual severing of this very entrenched bad relationship. So I think that it either has to be about them breaking out on their own, or it does have to be this kind of clean break. And the first episode does a really good job telling you everything you need to know by showing you all of those very diegetic, time-travel-based flashbacks, while also making it clear that, you know, Loki is in this literal bubble, that he's operating in this other, you know, very defined kind of, like, physical space, and that he's on his own. He's at the mercy of this larger power. So I think they do a really good job using the story to kind of quarantine him away and force the audience to embrace him as protagonist, force, you know, the character to step up in a way that he hasn't before. And we're all kind of working together, right? The audience members and the creators are all making a bold declaration that this is the Loki show starring Loki, and they're writing a story that facilitates that, while still giving all the new viewers everything that they need to know about the Thor relationship that kind of built this guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting, and I'm interested to see if the central question of the show is what makes a Loki, right? Then an interesting approach they seem to be taking here is let's refract that Lokiism across multiple characters. And in doing so, you can get to the heart of, you know, we met the Sylvie character played by Sophia DiMartino in the post-credit stinger of episode 4. We see a couple other Lokis. Presumably, we'll get to know them a bit more. And in doing so, find the common thread. And that's going to be able to help us understand who Loki is. And something I thought that was so interesting that you did in the five-issue run that you did is that you had several instances. I just reread it this morning, and you had several instances where you talk about these different iterations: Kid Loki, Lady Loki, King Loki, etc. The great chess sequence that you have in your comic goes into that as well. And I was just wondering, like, Loki is inherently a shapeshifter, but what do you recall about how useful it was for you to think about his varying identities when trying to paint your version of him?
I think that's almost a mandate at this point. Mm-hmm. I think that it would be dishonest to the character if you didn't incorporate all of these transformations, because Loki's doing it in this very, like, literal day-to-day sense, right? Like, I'm gonna turn into a wolf and be part of this weird mythological story where I screw with Thor.
Right.
But he's also being reinvented all of the time. And kind of, you know, all comic book characters sort of are, to some extent. All of the many-decade story sequential characters are getting all of these little transformations and settlings coming out as new definitive versions and having these eras. But Loki is someone who's literally doing it. Loki isn't just doing it for the audience's sake. Loki knows that this is happening because that's kind of the gag. He's in a live story, and he's the only one who has a sense of humor about it. So I think that's just part and parcel with the character, is that he knows that he contains all of these multitudes and is a fluid person on every level. There's a wonderful line from the Journey into Mystery era with Kid Loki, which mm-hmm. is I think largely the writer Kieran Gillen, but I think this particular line might be Matt Fraction, where he says, "I remain mysterious even to myself." And that I love. That to me is Loki, that he has a degree of self-awareness that lets him be this kind of game master, but he's also a little bit outside of himself, and he knows that he's impulsive. He doesn't always know what he's going to do. And TV show is also doing a great job of that. The self-sabotage aspect of it
mm-hmm.
is so clutch, because he's operating on the rules of mythology. So he kind of has to fail, because that's the way his universe is wired.
It's interesting that you mentioned that Kid Loki comic, because I was thinking about it a lot as I was rereading your run, because there are times when Loki has been a stone cold villain, and there are times when he has tried to play the hero, and there are times when, in trying to play the hero, he's not given a chance to play the hero, almost. Like, no, that's not your role, Loki. Like, or there's too much distrust, there's too much history, you're not allowed to change course. We need you as our villain. Is that something is that a perspective that you brought to your run? Like, when you get assigned a Loki run, do you get to decide whether or not this is going to be a heroic Loki or a villainous Loki or some shade in between?
Well, I think it's all very collaborative, right? Because it's comics. Mm-hmm. So there's wherever the universe is at that time, and the idea is that the editors, in my case, the editors Will Moss and Sarah Brunstad, were coming out of the War of the Realms crossover, and the status quo of the War of the Realms crossover is that Loki is king of the Frost Giants, and he gets this gig through a heroic act. So the idea of a hero Loki or a king Loki or a Loki who's trying to be a hero was sort of where we were all starting from. And then I think certainly in like Marvel and DC Comics writing, what's exciting for the writer is getting to pitch, like, well, how do we unpack that? Not what is the status quo, because it's whatever it is when you arrive, but how does it actually play out based on what I know about this character? So for me, that was the entire game. It's exactly what you're describing. What happens to someone who genuinely tries and the world will not let him? Because I think that we've all been in that position to some extent, whether it's just, you know, a boss who hates you or a relationship where you're getting punished for trying as hard as you can. In the letters column, I write about junior high. I write about finding out that you're a bad kid. You don't know that you're a bad kid until somebody tells you you're a bad kid.
Yeah, you have this really great line about being too clever for your own good and sort of what that phrase means to you that I really love. That cleverness is a destructive force in that phrase, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, it's very much playing with matches. And I think that's one of the interesting things about Loki is that you see a lot of Loki as a kid, and his parentage is part of it, and his sibling relationship is part of it. And that's a little rare in superhero comics. I mean, you see them as kids a lot if it's part of their origin story, like Batman or something. But sure. Batman doesn't have an older brother who's a better Batman. Like, you get to see Loki kind of learn that he has a different set of skills, and they're not really valued by the culture that he lives in.
Mm. Yeah, Odin, you know, certainly in the MCU version of Odin, is constantly banging on about worthiness, right? Are you worthy? And, like, that seems to be inherent to Loki is, like, I mean, to Thor as well, but, like, to Loki, this idea of not as worthy as Thor, whatever it is that we're chasing. Thor has a better grasp of it than you, sort of thing. And that's a really tough and dramatic thing for a kid. I don't usually, I wouldn't usually do this, which is float a theory past you, but, I want to do it because I think it would go somewhere kind of fruitful, which is this idea that, like, there's a theory that one of the reasons that these Lokis are being pruned, as they are, is because they were Lokis that were maybe tending towards heroism rather than villainy. We see Sylvie being sort of snatched from Asgard as a young girl, and we don't know why. And the only thing we know about her is that she's sort of playing with toys there, and she's playing the hero. She's playing the Valkyrie in that thing. And so there's this theory I really like that, like, if a Loki tends towards heroism on a path, that's a path that needs pruning because whoever is looking after the sacred timeline needs Loki to play the villain rather than the hero. Just conceptually, whether or not you think that's true, just conceptually, do you think that's an interesting thing to explore? This idea of, like, did Loki ever have a choice to be a hero if someone's out there pruning all the realities where he's where he is one, you know?
I love this idea. Yeah, obviously I can't, you know, speculate on what is going to happen, but I'm watching the same show as everybody else. And it is the show where Loki is the protagonist and he's up against forces. So there's something very, very logical about it and something very potentially soul-crushing if it does pay off that way. It's very much what I was interested in my run. I think the last dedicated Loki run before mine is the incredible Agent of Asgard comic that ran for 17 issues, I believe, Al Ewing and mostly Lee Garbett. And they play with that a lot. I mean, Al and Kieran, those guys are so smart about mythology and about self-aware storytelling, and I think that makes sense for a Loki story. If you're gonna figure out what the Loki story is in order to give him a television show, which is often how it works with these Marvel characters, you kind of figure out, like, what's the Spider-Man story when you're doing your first movie, you know? What's the Batman story? It's probably him and Joker. So the Loki story, if it's not going to involve Thor, it can still be the Loki story philosophically if it's about a guy who can't win. If it's about a guy who, literally because he is a creature of myth, cannot win. And then also as a character who is relatable to us, just, like, can't catch a break. Like, can't win in the traditional sense. But also literally is not permitted by the universe to win. That's a very interesting and ultimately very tragic idea that I really love, and I love for the character.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see what happens, obviously. But I was just, you know, in thinking it through, I think it would be incredible stuff for Tom Hiddleston to play this idea of I never had a chance to be Thor. if you need me to be your monster, I don't know. I wanted to ask you something about something I love particularly about your run is how well you capture. I mean, there's a lot to love, but how well you
this
capture-
is very nice of you. Thank you.
It's true. I mean, it's true. It's true. I
it
think
was,
it's,
we
I think
got just- five beautiful issues that I'm so proud of, but. I think I said off mic, it's tough to get people to buy a book about the bad guy, at least until the TV show comes out, and then people get excited about it again.
People want to go back.
So,
but something,
yeah.
Something that I loved about your run is that you did such a good job of, I mean, it's a complicated thing between Marvel Comics, the publishing arm, and the MCU, right? They're not the same continuity. It's not the same story, but the movies, because they become so predominant in the way in which we think about these characters, can't help but inform the way that those characters are written in the comic side. And so all of a sudden you see characters start to look a little bit more like the actors who are portraying them occasionally. And something that I think you captured so well, and I hope it was intentional, is the, you know, the debonair, charming Tom Hiddleston voice, also the Robert Downey Jr. voice, because Iron Man has a role to play. Was that your... Please tell me that was your intent, and I'm complimenting you and not insulting you.
Oh, no,
anyway.
No, thoroughly.
Okay.
I mean, yeah, my feeling on all that stuff is, how can you not? I think that the old saying, which I don't even know how old a saying it is, I think I might have gotten it from Joe Quesada, is that every comic could be somebody's first comic.
Mm.
And the odds are they're familiar with these characters already. And Loki and Iron Man are really good examples of characters who have been iconically meshed with their actors. Just, there's no going back. I think Loki is going to sound like Tom Hiddleston for a real long time. And if I hadn't purchased a Loki comic before, I would probably be expecting him to talk like Tom Hiddleston Loki. And I think you have a contract with the audience that is open to your interpretation as a creator. If you want to challenge them and be like, hey, I'm going to blow your mind. You know Loki from the movies, but he's actually like this more sinister Jack Kirby creation with what is now Richard E. Grant's costume, with with
yes.
Like, big curvy horns and sort of a mustache twirling, like, and he says, like, thou a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was available to me, I imagine. It's probably a hard pitch to my editors to say, like, I wanna make it as different from the really popular movies as possible. But for me, I love Tom Hiddleston's performance of Loki. I think that he loves and understands that character in one of those kind of all-timer actor superhero character pairings that you get, you know, like Ron Perlman as Hellboy or Margot Robbie as Harley Quinn. You really feel like they love being that person. And when you see Tom come out as Loki at Comic-Con and just do it, just like not,
yes.
Not scripted, just he's just living it. That is energy that you should take advantage of as a creator, and lean into. And I think give people enough of what they're expecting that they feel satisfied, but then whet their appetites for whatever twist you're going to put onto it.
I think that's brilliant. What are your hopes for these Loki variants that we meet at the end of episode 4?
I mean, I want to see Richard Grant do whatever he's got planned. This is the greatest thing that has ever happened on my television screen. I haven't been reading any of the rumors. Here's what a dumb I am. I saw the screen grab of that thing, and I had no idea what it was because I didn't watched all through the credits, because there's not a post-credits scene every time.
Right.
So
right.
as soon as that habit is broken, I'm just the lazy idiot who stops looking for the Easter eggs. It's like, somebody will surely tell me if there's something else here. So I started seeing screen grabs of that online, and I had to go, like, retroactively figure out, like, is this some, you know, BitTorrent leak from China or something? It's like, no, dude, that's in the show. Just sit patiently for 5 seconds. I'm thrilled. I think they're going to go on a crazy, you know, a crazy Loki's 11. Whatever the next phase of this heist is, I think we have 2 episodes left. So yeah. I have to imagine that it's going to be some kind of mission to get back to where Sylvie and Gugu Mbatha are hanging out.
I am also excited just to watch Rishi Grant, I don't know, devour every stick of scenery around him in that incredible costume. And I can't believe they got him to put that costume on.
It's
really impressed.
So satisfying. And that's the trick, right? Like, they're starting to do that kind of stuff with Spider-Verse. And, you know, from what it sounds like, this new live-action Spider-Man movie might have...
Potentially.
Yeah, use that as, like, a proof of concept and... Be like, okay, we're gonna start getting really meta with now what are now very sophisticated mainstream audiences, and let the different versions of these characters live side by side. But again, that's always been Loki's deal.
Did you have a moment watching the show where you just felt like you felt very sure that they knew exactly what they were doing with Loki? Was there a scene where you're like, oh, yeah, they know who Loki is and they're doing it?
Oh, yes, 100%. It's when they go to Pompeii and Tom Hiddleston plays Loki as not nihilistic exactly, but sort of like gleefully fatalistic. And they set it up in an earlier scene where he's just so delighted to probably be right about this thing. And he's getting a foothold for the first time in the series. He's playing by their rules in a way that has earned him a little bit of success. And he's getting very smug very quickly. And he is high status out of nowhere. That's very authentic to me. This idea that he's been knocked on his heels, but as soon as he has the opportunity to be right about something, he immediately goes very, very dark and very, very playful and just has a blast, having a blast at the end of the world.
I love it. And then what do you make of this this romance that they've given between Sylvie and Loki, this idea of Loki falling in love with himself?
I mean, when you say it outright like that, it kind of makes sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, if not another Loki, then who? That's another thing that sort of differentiates Loki from other comic book characters, is that there was never any real attempt at traditional romance, except in that sort of more old-fashioned comic booky way of the bad guy has an evil girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, there'd be other Asgardian characters that he's attached to in sort of like the larger soap opera when that cast starts to get really rounded out. But Loki doesn't really seem interested in romance, but I suppose that in meeting another Loki, he is a big enough narcissist that he would be passively charmed into caring about a version of himself enough to protect it, that the self-interest could be contagious as long as it was another self.
There's also and this is a reason that I'm responding to it in addition to every smart thing you just said, is this idea of like not having to explain yourself to someone who is so like you. Do you know, there's this question of like, would you rather your partner be just like you, or would you rather your partner be challenge you on every sort of level. And it's good to be challenged. And I don't think we could accuse Sylvie of not challenging Loki. But I think this idea of a familiarity, a relief of like not having to constantly explain yourself, because Loki has always come from this position of being othered in Asgard, right? This idea of having to sort of justify his existence, having to explain himself. Nobody understands him. He's constantly being thought of as the villain when maybe that's not what he was even trying to do. And this idea of the relief, I can imagine, of not having to justify your own existence to someone else who has experienced those things you've experienced. Do you know?
I viscerally relate to this. I was thinking the same thing as I was watching it. I've been married for about 4 years, and we're expecting our first child yesterday. She is.
Congratulations!
Hey, thank you. Yeah, she's running a little late. But what usually happens with the Loki show is that I watch it immediately to avoid spoilers, and then my wife Jennifer and I watch it again later in the day. And I was watching the bit where they're fleeing from the comets, you know, the shards of planet, and he yells out, "You're so weird," at her. And the effortless shorthand of talking to someone who is essentially you in a teasing, but also difficult to describe, like, utterly intimate way, like a way that's completely free of boundaries. That's something I really relate to in my fourth year of marriage, is that we've functionally become, especially after a quarantine, we've functionally become two halves of the same person, which is really nice. I think sometimes it's called codependency. Sometimes it's sometimes it's called enmeshing, is my understanding. So it really depends on, you know, if things are going well.
Right, right.
But since things are going well, I told her, I see it. I totally see it. There's a couple on TV that reminds me of us, and it's because they are one person.
I love that. Something that I want to circle back to, this idea of like what makes the Loki story, something that I love that's in your comic is this idea of like, if Loki's not starting the story being cast out of somewhere, is it truly a Loki story? Is a question that you ask. And I think the show fulfills this prompt. You know what I mean? Like he starts literally like sort of sailing out of somewhere and then yanked out of Earth. So it's that sort of like disruptive pull or push or shove. Is that how you view it?
Absolutely. I think that's in the DNA. I think that if you're looking for that core, especially in a self-aware way, when the semi-omniscient trickster 10 steps ahead narrator is telling you what his story is, I certainly was always looking for the balance of what does he know, what does he not know, how do I keep the danger real? But at the same time, he is like a god telling his own story. Right. So you're gonna break the fourth wall a little in a Loki's name on the cover comic book is probably gonna break the fourth wall a little bit. And I had most recently, I think before that, done a Deadpool versus Black Panther story where Deadpool has similar kind of fourth wall breaking mm-hmm. abilities. His are accepted culturally. Loki's are written in. Loki literally has the power to screw around with story. So he knows how his story started. He was a frost giant who ended up in Asgard. And then he got exiled from Asgard. Like, that's his deal. Loki gets kicked out. He starts trouble. And he gets asked to leave. The first time was not by choice. That's what makes it tragic. But I think what all the recurring superheroes are doing, and what a lot of us are doing in various ways that makes us relate to them, is living these repeated patterns. And over, you know, the course of many, many decades, and maybe indefinitely, because the demands of the readership and the marketplace won't let these characters change too much, are exploring their trauma and growing tiny, 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 tiny bits at a time.
Yeah. And I guess the last thing that I want to, and like, that's been a, I'm really enjoying these Disney Plus shows, some more than others, as it should be. But like, that has been sort of a, not a critique, but just sort of an observation that I've seen, that some folks are wondering, like, if these are acting as kind of interstitial stories between MCU films. To go back to your Joe Quesada quote, like, you can't presume that everyone watching the movies has seen all the television. And so I kind of think that, like, whatever happens in the TV, even if we get introduced to characters, there still is going to have to be a viewer-friendly way into the films. And in that way, can those characters demonstrably change over the course of the TV show? Or do they have to stay in a certain, on a certain path? I don't know if you have any thoughts about that.
Well, I think it's potentially a valid criticism to say that the characters are not changing enough, because I think the audience has never been more savvy about what is necessary for these franchises to continue. I think there's a little bit of Dunning-Kruger effect in there, where we don't really know as much as we think we do, and we project these kind of, like, you know, these master plans onto Warner Brothers and Disney executives that are not really borne out by reality, because, like, yeah, I certainly saw Samuel Jackson show up at the end of the first Iron Man movie, and we all had our theories about where it was going, but no one can replace, like, or no one can predict, like, Edward Norton being replaced with Mark Ruffalo, right? Like, it, this is happening on such a massive scale that things just happen. Like, regular showbiz things happen. Like, they're not gods. Like, the plan changes constantly, and I think the strength of the writing is that they remember what they've done already and capitalize on it retroactively to look like geniuses. And I think that is a kind of genius, is to hold it all in your head and take advantage of all the opportunities that you've maybe subconsciously set up for yourself. But, like, at the end of the day, they're not immune to the rules of regular television programs, which are just, the characters don't change that much on The Office either. You know, right. Like, they get married or they have a baby, but they don't change the way that Thanos doing the snap changes everything. Like, right. it's a very recent promise that there is going to be these massive status quo shifts in movies and television programs for most of the history of this kind of media. It's just Seinfeld. It just happens until it doesn't.
Right. And then I just wanted to, I mean, so for folks who haven't read your run, I hope they go out and read it right now. It's an like, heartbreakingly short read, because it's only 5 issues. And so, but, you know, if someone's feeling daunted, I can say, you're just going to read 5 issues. You're going to read them lickety split. They're so good. They're so fun.
It's one paperback too. It's just the one book.
But I was wondering if you could talk about sort of what happened with your run there.
Well, it ended, obviously. You've stated as much. I think it just got canceled. I mean, there was never a conversation about making any changes to it, or, you know, trying to put Spider-Man on the cover more. Honestly, we put Wolverine on the cover of number 5 before we knew it was going to get canceled. And that's the kind of thing that historically you do in comics to raise sales, is you put Wolverine on the cover and he saves the day. So that was something that we had already planned on doing. No, I think it's just a tough sell. It's a weird book. My biggest influence in writing it, obviously, in addition to Tom Hiddleston's portrayal of Loki in the movies, and to the many, many, many incredible Loki and just Thor comics that shaped this character. I was also thinking a lot about Sandman. I was thinking about comics about regular people brushing up against the cosmic, and about cosmic people trying to be regular people. And it's not quite the same as as Spider-Man fighting Dr. Octopus. I think that comics are tough in general because there's so much good, weird, new, interesting stuff coming out all the time, especially, I would say even in superhero titles, even in the characters who are very familiar and very commercialized, there's still all of this weird, challenging, status quo disrupting stuff that happens pretty regularly. But there's also a lot of habit buying. There's a lot of people who buy the titles that they buy, and it's kind of hard to get to a comic book store for a lot of people. You know, they don't have them in the supermarket like they did at one point in the medium's history. So it's tough to get people to take a chance on something new and on something weird, and I just feel really, really lucky that for the folks who did read it, they've had such incredibly kind things to say, and that it is getting this little second life from the TV show. I hope people check out all of the Loki comics, the ones that I read to help me figure out who this person was.
Excellent. Well, folks can get your Loki comic where they get most comics. And Daniel, thanks so much for chatting with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a blast.
Where can folks find you online if they want to follow you?
I am at Kibblesmith on social media, which we're all trying to use a little less, I think. And I am at kibblesmith.com.
And you're about to be a dad, so you might vanish entirely. Yeah, but then again, there's those late night sort of feeding times or whatever that where social media, you might start social mediaing at weird hours. That might happen as well.
I'm either going to vanish entirely or there's going to be a lot of like 2 a.m. shower thoughts and baby pictures.
Excellent. All right. Thanks so much. I look forward to the shower thoughts. All right. Finally, a voice you might be a little bit more familiar with. It's Anthony Brezdikin. Hello, Anthony.
Hello, Joanna Robinson. Good to be with you.
Always great to have you here. As I mentioned at the top of the show, we're doing things a little differently this week because Richard has been pruned away to France. On this episode of Still Watching Loki, we are going to do a little bit of mailbag work here in the back third with you.
Excellent.
So we can check in with our listeners who wrote in, as always, very thoughtful, interesting emails. But before we get to that, I mean, is there anything that you want to make sure we talk about before we get into emails?
Folks have already heard Mark Bernardin talk to you, right, about the show. So, sure. I wanted to say, coincidentally, I have a feature on Mark Bernardin in his new graphic novel, Adora in the Distance, coming out. So you can see that on vanityfair.com. And, it's just one of the crazy things about being thrown into the void at the end of time together is that we're somehow, all of our lives are touching right here on this podcast in surprising ways.
So you guys can go over and read up on Mark and everything that he's up to. He's always doing 1 million different projects. So he's just the busiest guy. So thank him, of course, for taking time to talk to me about Loki. How about anything about the episode that you want? Is there anything you want to talk about?
Well, the first thing I asked was, did you talk to Mark about Frog Thor? Because, you know, my wife and I watched it at midnight, and after a long day, you know, you start to doubt your senses. And as the camera pans down and we're looking at, I guess there are some sort of lunch trays.
Yeah.
And then, a jar with a little frog in it who's dressed as Thor leaping around. And the frog is labeled T365, which I'm guessing is Thor issue number 365, which I believe is from 1966. Mark probably already, and you probably already covered this ground, but I was right away like, what is that? I can't say that I was ever aware that Thor turned into a frog and led the frogs in a battle against alligators and rats, some sort of epic war of the vermin. So
I was aware of Frog Loki, Frog Thor, only because I read too much Reddit, and Reddit was like, Frog Thor when Alligator Loki showed up, they're like, why isn't there Frog Thor if there's Alligator Loki? And then there was Frog Thor for them, so it was a cute little Easter egg.
I did know the Thanos copter, so I think that this episode with the this sort of abandoned carnival of discarded remnants from other variants is a great place for the writers to really stretch and throw Easter eggs at us.
Just totally.
Rapid fire, like Elf throwing snowballs. Easter egg, Easter egg, Easter egg.
Completely.
What's with the I gotta ask you, what's with the food trays, the TV dinner trays?
I don't know, but Mark and I were theorizing that perhaps that's how people bust their trays at the TVA. They just zap it into the void. But I don't have a better answer than that. So
that's funny. Doesn't Homer Simpson do something like that when there's like a black hole? Like he feeds the black hole just by throwing junk into it all the time and it grows.
I mean, it would be tempting mm-hmm. to just sort of make all your dishes go away by zapping them. I don't know. I do think this was a fairly organic place to put just 1 million different Easter eggs and that it didn't bother me, you know?
And the most ridiculous comic book tropes, and flights of fancy, like the Thanos copter, I don't know, the Mad Titan just going around in a little Bell helicopter never really made sense to me, but. There you go.
So I want to start by asking you about the man behind the curtain, which is a reference that they make. I mean, I told Mark this a little bit, but like the Easter egg, the reference that felt the strongest to me was the smoke monster from Lost. But that's probably because I talk about Lost every week on a Lost podcast. But Eliath is a comic book figure. It's not like they made it up. It is a comic book figure. We call the smoke monster on my Lost podcast, we call it the old clickety-clack because it has this like sound design. And there's just a similar
sound.
Yeah, there's a similar sound design on this particular smoke monster. So it made me think of that. But there's a bunch of Eliath and a few other things like the thing that we thought was Avengers Tower. I mean, it is Avengers Tower. But instead of having the A on it for Avengers, it had don't know if I'm pronouncing this correctly, but I think it's Kang, but it's Q-E-N-G, Tower. And that is a reference to Kang the Conqueror in the comic books, that he like in one of his guises bought the Stark Tower and put the Kang thing on it. Anyway, there are a lot of Kang references in all of this.
Pretty good about our Kang theorizing.
Okay, so one of the questions that Christina asked was, it has to be Kang in that castle, right? Like, the color scheme this episode matches his own. And then Eliath, do you think there is still a chance it's not Kang? And if so, on a scale of 1 to 10, how pissed will the fans be? All signs point to Kang. That I feel like it would be just a huge F you if they make it something else, someone else. And this is from Christina. So I want to throw that to you, but I want to say really quickly, Mark and I talked about this a little bit, not this question directly, but just a little bit about Kang. But the question is, what does Christina mean by fans? Because the only people who might be irate if a Kang didn't show up are people who have a lot of comic book knowledge or people who spend a lot of time on Reddit, right? Because if you're just like a casual viewer, none of these little, breadcrumbs are going to add up to Kang in your mind because you don't know who the heck Kang is. So what do you think about that, Anthony?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think those casual fans roll with the punches on everything. So they're never the ones who are going to be distraught if something doesn't happen. But I think they've hyped Kang enough and they've talked about the casting, confirmed the casting of Jonathan Majors. So who we've name checked quite a few times here. So I think they're clearly building to something, but I still think there's a reversal coming. I got my eye on Miss Minutes.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
you know,
more than ever, I have got my eye on Miss Minutes as well. I agree with you.
Here's the thing. If it is Kang, how is he monitoring what goes on at the TVA? And if you want to know what's going on in your business, what better way than to be the living Slack channel that consults with everybody, you know?
For sure. The live Clippy. I mean, I don't know how I feel about Kang at this point without a name check yet in the series. I know we've talked about it as a potential theory, but like, I'm kind of starting to lean towards they can't make Kang the big bad, but that they could, and Mark sort of mentioned this possibility, they could sort of set him up as a post-credits tease. But here's an observation from Liz. Liz writes in and she says about who the man behind the curtain is. By the way, man behind the curtain is, of course, a Wizard of Oz reference, but it also happens to be a title of an episode of Lost. Liz wrote, "This show has been tight and efficient with its characters, and whoever it is needs to be of emotional impact to Loki and Sylvie. To us, that feels like it narrows it down to another Loki variant, as there isn't really anyone else in the cast that could have that much of an emotional impact." So what do you think about that idea that, like, Kang might not pack the emotional punch required to make a satisfactory ending? It's just some stranger, I mean, as fantastic as Jonathan Majors is, and I believe he could sell anything, a stranger twirling his mustache out of the shadows at our heroes versus somebody they've seen already and know already in the show, whether it's a Loki variant or Mobius or Ravonna or something like that.
Yes, it makes sense. Typically, Marvel does not hide its villain, like the element of surprise. It's not an Agatha Christie story where you're shocked at whodunit. I think the closest they came was probably Agatha in WandaVision.
Well, I mean, I would agree with you about the MCU, but I would, well, I mean, with a few exceptions, you know, like Robert Redford, but that's like, that comes like midway through Winter Soldier,
yeah.
But with the Disney Plus shows, because it's not just Agatha, it's also Sharon Carter, right? Like that.
Oh yeah, yeah. You're right.
This
about
has
that.
Been sort of their approach for the TV shows. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're right. In the movies, they don't. The villain usually declares himself or herself, and now with the shows, they're kind of building up to little reveals. And I think it's a way of adding a twist, several episodes deep, that keeps things mixed up and fresh. So. Yeah, that's why I think there's going to be, I don't know whether I believe Ravonna that she doesn't believe, I don't know if I believe her that she doesn't know who's actually running things, who's actually pulling the strings, who's the person behind the curtain. But I do suspect that Kang is a part of it. I just think they've laid too much groundwork for it to go back now. But I could also see there being a Loki, that Loki is his own worst enemy, right? That maybe there is a bigger bad. I'm not sure who would play that version of him. Would it be Tom Hiddleston?
It might be Hiddleston. Yeah, I mean, I keep coming back. I feel unwilling to let go of this idea of Mobius being a Loki variant. And there's a couple things that he says in this episode that sort of reinforces that for me. At one point he, like when they're in the void, he says, well, you can't throw a rock in here without hitting a Loki, which just felt like a little bit like if he's a Loki himself, it's kind of funny. But then also when he's talking to classic Loki, is played by Richard E. Grant, he says something about like he's talking about alligator Loki, and he says, maybe he's lying, the long con. Of course, that just makes him more likely to be a Loki. It's always the game within the game with you guys, which I respect. Something that Mobius says.
Yeah.
It's always the game within the game with you guys, which I respect, the long con. Also, another name of a lost episode. but, you know, it's...
I guess those are good clues, but I also just feel like he's not deceiving us when he has issues with the rings. Like maybe Mobius is as surprised as anybody to find that a variant of that. You know what it could be? Is a Mobius variant.
Could be a Mobius variant, or it could be that he's a Loki variant and he doesn't know he's a Loki variant. Something that I think is interesting is that like B-15 had, we talked about this last week, but B-15 had her awakening by seeing her past life. But Mobius finds out the truth without diving into...
Without evidence. Yeah, he doesn't go back to the past. Yeah.
So, and he says, maybe I had a jet ski. And we're all like, oh yeah, we called it, the 90s, a jet ski. That's definitely where Mobius is from. But the show has still not told us who Mobius was before he worked at the TVA.
You're right.
You know? Which is dicey to me. So,
which means there's a reveal still to come there. They're going to have to show you.
Yeah. Or at least tell us. So, there you go. So, I don't know. I mean, like, I think it would break Loki Prime's heart. I mean, he hugged Mobius, you know, he was like, my friend, thank you, you know, teary eyed. Like, I think it would break his heart if he were the big bad in some way. But there are things that have happened that make it feel less likely to me. So I'm not 100% sold on it. I'm just got my eye on it. You know?
He also says, what are you going to do? And he goes, burn it to the ground, which doesn't sound like something a hero says.
Right. Like maybe his whole game was to
destabilize the TVA.
Yeah, destabilize the TVA. And he's like, how can I use these Lokis to do that? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know. I just think it's interesting. And I'm trying to understand the Ravonna Mobius relationship a bit better because, you know, sometimes they throw hints into those previously ons of like, we want to make sure you paid attention to this moment, you know? And one of the things in the previously on was Ravonna talking to Mobius and talking about how she's trying to protect him.
Yeah.
So I don't know, like maybe he is a Loki who she like had a soft spot for and she keeps wiping his memory to keep him on his loop or, you know, and if he finds out the truth, I don't know. But some reveal is coming for Mobius. Some kind.
Yeah, they're definitely laying groundwork. I agree 100%.
All right. Amy wrote in and she says, what makes a Loki a Loki is obviously a central question of the show. But to me, it feels like the character / emotional thesis of the show is we Lokis don't need to be alone. You can track this all the way through Loki's appearances in the MCU, even in Thor: The Dark World, when cut off in prison, he makes one of the worst choices that leads to Frigga's death. Thinking about that in regards to Loki joining Sylvie and the strength of them to change the course of the universe, what are your thoughts about where the next ep might go? And do you have any overarching thesis for Loki, emotional / lore or otherwise? Amy, what do you think about
that? Yeah, I think this has become the theme, is that more the merrier, right? To be glib about it, Loki is finding a family, but they're all fellow Lokis. So he's also meeting people who have regrets about whether, you know, kid Loki killed Thor. And I don't know, maybe he doesn't feel bad about that. But the others, didn't classic Loki say he missed Thor?
Yeah, that's why he came out of isolation.
Yeah. And so, you know, this notion of, you don't have to be a bad guy. You can do the right thing. Of course, that's what gets you pruned because Lokis are not supposed to do the right thing. But, you know, I like the notion of, I still think there's a King Herod biblical element to this because, okay, if you do something that gets you pruned or attracts the attention of the TVA, it's not just being different, because all these Lokis are so different from each other, right? You'd think the arrival of a female Loki just from birth would be, oh, whoops, this is the bad timeline. Like, we got to nip this back because there should be only one, right? It seems like Lokis are allowed to exist as long as they stay dastardly.
Right.
What is it that the Lokis who go good do that threatens the timekeepers? Like, I don't think there's just one timeline. I think there's maybe a rope made up of many timelines.
Yeah. Yes. We've seen that. I think in the animated depiction, there's little,
did they describe it that way?
I don't know that they described as a rope. I think that's a really smart way to describe it, but I think we have seen sort of like different tendrils and cords. And that was a question that someone asked. Let me find that question really quickly. But like, they were asking sort of how can there be these various variants? Here it is. Okay. Rob wrote in and said, why don't all Loki variants look like Tom Hiddleston? By the possibly false narrative of the TVA, there's one timeline, and anytime a person creates a Nexus event, they become a variant and the TVA nabs them. This occurs before the branch timeline reaches the red line and becomes permanent, so the TVA can and does just reset the timeline. So how could there be ever have been a branch of the timeline that happens before Loki's birth to cause him to be born an alligator or a woman, etc.? That branch would have been reset immediately upon its Nexus event occurring, rather than being allowed to continue to create an alternate universe / timeline. I understand the whole idea of the single sacred timeline may well be proven a lie, but you think they'd at least clue the viewer into how the TVA agents explain the phenomenon of alternative variants. Am I missing something? And I think to that, Rob, I would say not every diversion from the sacred timeline is a Nexus event. Not every diversion is something that is going to cause the timeline to go in a way that the timekeepers don't want it to. So in theory, there's a reality where Loki is an alligator and like does everything they need Loki to do. And that branch, as you described it, a rope, would just weave back into the main timeline. It wouldn't branch off in a dramatic way.
That would explain why Cap and Peggy would be able to maybe exist.
Oh boy.
In their timeline without getting pruned.
Maybe.
And and you know, why the Avengers could jump back and forth through time. Because at one point they say, well, they're supposed to do that.
Right.
Like, that's what's supposed to happen.
Right.
So the so I think it's the supposed to that is the subjective element here.
Correct.
So what is a Nexus event? What happens when it crosses that threshold where it can't be pruned back?
Right.
And I think that what they're actually pruning back are threats to the powers that be behind that curtain.
I agree with you completely.
Right. So if you're a Loki who goes good, they know the prophecy is that, a savior will rise. You know, this chosen one will come and take you down. So they have to take down any Loki. That's why there are so many of them there, because the minute they go good or develop a conscience, they get nixed.
That's like a classic fairy tale sort of thing, or like a self-fulfilling prophecy kind of thing where, like, I don't know, let's say the evil stepmother, evil queen or whatever, has every baby in the kingdom drowned because, you know, a baby is supposed to kill her, but she misses one. It's Willow, mm-hmm. right? You know, she misses, you just need to miss one.
Or in this case, you know? Or in this case, you nip them all in the bud, you take them all out, and you end up gathering them all in one place. So you have an army of Lokis coming at you.
Stronger together to,
Yeah, exactly. There really was like a lot of Wizard of Oz stuff. I thought the manifestation of Asgard with the green Loki glow looked very Emerald City, and
you know, it did look very Emerald City.
Have mentioned that.
No. I mean, I agree with you, but I haven't seen a lot of people say it, but I definitely thought that in my head. The other movie reference, I don't think I brought this up with Mark, but you know, when Loki's running to create his diversion for the smoke monster, that felt very like Ian Malcolm with the flare running out of the Jeep, waving mm-hmm. it, being like, hey, over here, don't attack her, attack me, sort of mm-hmm. thing.
So, yeah, very much.
Yeah. To go back to what you said about this idea of like why they're pruning these Lokis and at what point, right? Because we find out that Kid Loki killed Thor, and that was his Nexus event. I just want to say, in Kid Loki's defense, we don't know what that Thor was like. Maybe that Thor was evil. I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, we don't know what version of Thor that was that he killed. But classic Loki was pruned not because he evaded Thanos. And something that's interesting is did you know that was a common fan theory at the time in Infinity War, that Tom Hiddleston's Loki had just sort of like hidden himself in the debris in the background and was still alive? And so I felt like they were lampshading that fan theory by saying, yes, that's what Richard E. Grant's Loki did. But he gets pruned not because he escaped death, but because he came out of isolation. This idea of like goodness and non-isolation and all this sort of stuff. This is a question that Abby has. Of all the Lokis here, Richard E. Grant's Loki is the one who spent the most time alone and processed all the things that make a Loki a Loki and came out the other side of it unsure of his worth or usefulness and feeling doomed. This affects his ability to have that bold side of Loki we all know throughout the episode. He's always the one needing clarification or explanation from others. It's only when Mobius tells him it's never too late to change that something clicks for classic Loki. And he's unable to, ironically enough, fulfill the same type of purpose the TVA has for all Lokis, to sacrifice himself so others could be the best versions of themselves. I love this development so much, and this episode as a whole, and Richard E. Grant brought dignity to that insane costume. And mm-hmm. I completely agree. It's not really a question, but I just think that was definitely something that they wanted us to pay attention to, this idea of change for Loki, right? It's never too late to change who you are.
I think that's a powerful message, and you know, as a kid, he used to get into a lot of trouble in the back of the classroom and was a smart aleck and really not much of anything worth saving. I'm really grateful to the people in my life who saw potential for something better. And so I think every person needs to hear that. If you're told you're bad, I think I said this in the last episode, but if you're told you're bad and told you're worthless and told you're undeserving of anything, including love or happiness or forgiveness, you really start to believe it. And I think that makes a lot of toxic people. But the minute you, because if you're told that over and over again and you believe it, you kind of sabotage when good things happen to you, because it's just some part of you that won't accept it. And I think these Lokis are discovering maybe there is something about me that's salvageable, which is funny because they're in sort of a cosmic junkyard.
One theory I saw it on Reddit, and I apologize, I don't have the user's name, but in terms of like this balance of like, are we going to get a Kang reveal or are we going to get something more Loki centric in the finale? They posited this idea that like, in order to take down whoever is behind the TVA right now, be it a Loki variant or whoever, in doing so, our Lokis might accidentally free a Kang who's been held prisoner. Like maybe Kang was running the TVA. He's been imprisoned by a Loki and they free him. So he's not the big bad of the season, but they are responsible for unleashing him on the MCU. You know, just that's a wild out of just the thoughts in that person's head theory, but I don't dislike it because it involves Kang without making Kang the emotional fulcrum of the ending. Do you know?
Yeah, I agree. I think that's the tricky balance, right? Is you don't want to just throw in a rando and people go, who's Kang? Like, right. There has to be some thread back to something we've seen before. I just don't know where that's going to be.
Yeah, it's true.
It's good that they've got us along this far without us totally figuring it out.
I know. It's true. It's true. It's good. It's good story. I mean, like, the Ravonna stuff is so interesting because, like, I am on, you know, you said you thought she was lying about not knowing who was behind the TVA. We know that she's lying for some of this episode, but Gugu Mbatha-Raw is so good at whatever she's doing that I genuinely don't know. I mean, I knew she was lying when she was like, I'm going to help you, Sylvie, and yes, we're going to go save Loki and stuff like that. I knew that was a lie. But there's other things where I'm like, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know. You know? When she's like, let's figure this out and sort of save the day, I'm like, really? Because you were just like,
oh, yeah,
about to sacrifice everybody and take them down. Like, did she not really know that those were animatronics and not the real powers behind the throne? Like, I don't know that I trust that character.
I agree. I don't trust her. The only thing that I kind of trust is like B-15's read of her. I don't know why B-15's read of her would be incorrect, why they would show us that scene if it were incorrect. And she was just saying like, you want to know who's behind all this because you don't, you know? So I don't know. It's something to think about, but, speaking of people who might crop up, this is something I briefly mentioned in the first segment, but I want to drop the full thing on you. I love it when our listeners go granular. Joy wrote in and she said, going off something Joanna said about the end credits when you guys were discussing the Falcon and the Winter Soldier, in the Loki end credit sequence, there are two cards left that haven't had names attached. The shot of the card catalog and the shot of the Loki file stamped apprehended. So far, here's the order. Tom Hiddleston, Sophia DiMartino, Gugu Mbatha-Raw, Wunmi Mosaku, Eugene Cordero, Sasha Lane, Tara Strong, Jack Veal, Dobia Oparai, blank, Richard E. Grant, blank, Owen Wilson. So going in order, and something that I noticed in the credit, I didn't notice those blanks, so thank you, Joy. Joy says, going by this, I feel like whoever those last two names are, they're going to be important either to the story or a big name actor. So maybe people theorizing about Kang, Jonathan Majors are onto something, or it's actor playing characters no one's discussed yet. Either way, I'm feeling pretty excited about whatever episode 6 has in store. The placing of those blanks is interesting because if you pay attention to actor billing credits on things, Richard E. Grant got a special guest star before his name, which is something your agent negotiates for you. It's like a special status. And Owen Wilson has a with Owen Wilson at the end, and that's also something your agent will negotiate for you, special status. But there's something in between special guest star Richard E. Grant and with Owen Wilson that, you know, could be and Jonathan Majors or and Rene Russo or and Chris Hemsworth or something like that. I don't want to get us too hyped for actors who aren't going to appear, but that's just something to pay attention to, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do. I agree.
Who would, other than Jonathan Majors, who would be on your wish list for someone who might show up? Knowing that we're not getting our hopes up too high and we won't be mad if no one shows up.
Wanda.
Elizabeth Olsen?
Well, and Elizabeth Olsen. She's scanning the multiverse, right? Oh, looking true. For her boys. So,
true.
You know.
I love it. All right. We got this fun email from Tom about Loki mythology. Tom writes in and says, while watching the show Loki, I came to the realization that he seems to have an almost backwards story arc in the MCU compared to Norse mythology. In the MCU, Loki starts off being more of a bad guy and softens as it goes on. In Norse mythology, Loki would regularly do things to annoy the other gods, and for the most part, his tricks were relatively harmless. He wasn't an evil god and was trusted by the others until he was responsible for the death of Baldur. In fact, the fourth episode even referenced a trick he pulled that led to the creation of probably the most famous item from Norse mythology. In the story, Loki, for some reason, decided it would be funny to cut Sif's hair. He promised to make things right for her. He then had two sets of doors set out to make gifts for the gods. There were six things made total, but the most important of them being new hair for Sif and Mjolnir, Thor's hammer. If it wasn't for Loki being a prankster, Thor would never have his hammer. This isn't any theorizing or anything like that, just some observations I had and I thought you'd find interesting. So,
well, I do find it interesting.
What we saw was a reference to the creation of Mjolnir in that haircut time loop with Sif. So I thought that was kind of fun. We didn't get an email about this, but I wanted to ask you how you're feeling about the Sylvie Loki connection.
It feels a little weird to me, to be honest.
Does it?
Because it's starting to get romantic. At least it feels intimate.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. They feel like brother and sister to me. So, like, it just, I don't know how you're supposed to feel about that. Is that what you're asking me? Like,
yeah. Does the romance play for you, or does it not?
It just kind of doesn't. I know they're separate, and it's they're playing off of a Narcissus thing, but. Yeah, I mean, I like that they have a bond. I don't ship these characters. I guess I'll put it that way.
I don't know. You and Mark, I will say, you and Mark had the exact same reaction. I think he also used the word weird, and he used it many more times than you did. So you're not alone in this stance. Plenty of people feel this way. I'm not bothered by it. The image of Tom Hiddleston, like, frantically running, doing the big hero romance run through the airport, but like through a junkyard to get to Sylvie. That worked on me. And like their blanket moment worked on me and all of that sort of stuff. Like I like them. It just feels like a meeting of the true minds sort of thing. I'm into it. So, you know, but plenty of people are not. So that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else you want to talk about in this episode? What else do you want to discuss?
Eliath, I would like, yeah. You know, we already mentioned the smoke monster aspect. I think, you know, look, he's a nebulous character, literally. I guess I'm gendering it. It's kind of a Godzilla looking thing based on the face, right? Like,
or T-Rex. Yeah. Smoky T-Rex. Godzilla. It felt very Godzilla when it was attacking the Emerald City version of Asgard. It was,
and if
like,
I'm correct, yeah. Eliath isn't like, it's not ancient comics lore. It's just like maybe 12 or 13 years back, right?
Yeah, not that old, I think.
So, I think anybody who's read my work knows I write a lot about Stephen King, and King had a short or a novella called The Langoliers, which was about a plane that flew through a some sort of time vortex, and only the people who were asleep on the plane came out the other side. Everybody else vanished. Everybody who's conscious vanished. So there are like 9 or 10 people who wake up on a plane that has no pilots. And one of the people, you know, lucky for them, is a pilot who was, you know, taking the flight back. I think he has a funeral to get to or something. So he can land the plane. And they land at the airport and they realize that the world around them, the food is that they find is like diminishing in flavor. The colors are becoming desaturated and the world itself is aging, and they theorize that this is sort of the remnant of a past time and that is growing stale. And there are these things on that come to the world called the Langoliers that are just sort of like these nebulous shapes that munch away and just essentially like, they're like the good bacteria that just devours the remains and of past timelines. And I can't help but think that Eliath is basically a big Langolier from Stephen King.
When was The Langoliers written?
It was, I want to say like early 90s.
Okay.
Maybe like 91, 92.
Eliath appears first time in 93 in the comics. Mm-hmm. So the timeline could definitely work out. It also feels very The Nothing from The Neverending Story to me.
Oh, yeah.
Also. But yeah, I mean, like, let me just read like one paragraph from the Marvel wiki for Eliath, just to like help people know how much of this feels Kang related. Kang created a barrier preventing Eliath from entering his domain. After Kang was left on the brink of death, Ravonna, the Terminatrix, assumed his identity and took over his empire. While investigating errors earlier in time, she accidentally released Eliath, who then threatened Kang's former domain and all the other temporal dominions. Further up the time stream, Ravonna and Revelation were able to revive Kang, who provided the Avengers with the Chrono Key to use against Eliath. So, like, this is all, it is all Kang lore. The Chronopolis, the city that we see as the clouds part, that's a Kang lore. Like, you know, it just all, it is all Kang lore. It does feel wild that it wouldn't be Kang. It just also feels like they should have dropped some Kang references in earlier if that's who it was going to be. Do you know what I mean? Like,
is this a little bit like Loki being the front man for the invasion of New York, but really it was Thanos behind the scenes? Like, are they laying the groundwork for Kang to be the Thanos of the next big cycle of Marvel?
I mean, I definitely think that they are planning for Kang to be Thanos. Like, I definitely don't think he's just an Ant-Man villain. And one of the reasons that I think that is just because of the way that, like, Jonathan Majors has talked about it. Do you know what I mean? I think this feels like a bigger, bigger commitment than just showing up in one Marvel movie. So Mark made a similar comparison. You guys are both very smart about this stuff. So I think you're probably right that, like, we might get like a post-credit sting as we did in Avengers of like, who's that purple guy? You know what I mean? But like, but it didn't make sense for Thanos to descend and like be in the Battle of New York for that story that they were telling. It made sense for that villain to be Loki. Do you know?
Because you're building to it, right? Yeah. That's just the first act. Yeah, it's the end of the first phase, but it's the really the first act in a bigger, like what they call it, the infinity cycle.
Yeah. We got an email sort of kind of about this from Christina. Christina wrote, at this point, it seems unavoidable that the Young Avengers are being set up for the MCU. We've talked about this a lot on this podcast. We met Kid Loki in this episode, right? And I, like many, suspect Kang is connected to the TVA. I also know from the comics that Kid Loki reassembles the Young Avengers at one point. So I highly suspect that Kang will be the villain of a Young Avengers movie and some version of Loki will assemble the team to stop him. Because my memory of this is that Kang, who shows up in various guises throughout Marvel Comics, one of his guises is as a member of the Young Avengers. There's like a young version of Kang that sort of infiltrates Young Avengers, I think, or something like that. So, you know, I mean, this Young Avengers stuff feels like a really long game they're playing. Do you know? Mm-hmm. But it definitely could involve Kang in some way. Iron Lad is a Kang guys. So there you go. I love that name, Iron Lad. Such a cute little thing. All right. So those are I think all the emails that we got. I guess, do you have any other thoughts or feelings or predictions? Oh, you seem like someone who might've done this. Have you read the book Snow Crash? By Neal Stephenson?
No.
Okay. Snow Crash came out early 90s, I want to say. And it's a great, 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 great sci-fi book that Ready Player One lifted from, let's say, liberally. You know, it's about a sort of post-apocalyptic world and these VR realities that most of the action takes place in and stuff like that. But the hero who's named Hero Protagonist, H-I-R-O Protagonist, and yes, like, I think both, you'll see that has been lifted in a couple other properties, but Hero Protagonist drives a pizza delivery car, and the opening of Snow Crash is about this, like, pizza delivery car, sort of on this madcap chase, through the plot of the book, and so I felt like Mobius's pizza delivery car was a Snow Crash reference, but I could be wrong.
I was kind of wondering about that. It seemed like an odd choice, but you know.
Someone else mentioned that it might be a reference. There's this pizza delivery truck in a lot of the Pixar films.
The Pizza Planet.
Yeah, and since, of course, Owen Wilson is a voice in Cars, that that it might be a Pixar connection instead. But
I don't know. I'd have to conjure an image of the vehicle, but I'd also read online today that somebody noted that the license plate is GRN,
Yeah.
And that, you know,
Grunwald.
Classic.
Yeah.
Well, classic Moby or classic Loki says something like, about whether the alligator Loki is really a Loki. He's like, well, he is green. Like
oh.
The green is like the symbol. So somebody was like, car Loki, you know, is it Loki is a car. So, maybe.
I thought people thought it was for Mark Grunwald, who's a comic book writer. But I like the idea of GRN instead green.
That's also very likely.
And who's inside that green car? Oh, it's
Mobius.
Yeah. All right. Anything else you want to?
You know, the elevator too has those symbols on it that look like hourglasses, but also could be Mobius strips. So maybe he is. Maybe he is the bad guy.
Maybe. Who knows? I mean, I don't feel certain one way or the other. I think there's a couple different ways that they can go. So that's exactly where we want to be, right? Uncertain, but having fun guessing. So
yeah.
And not getting too disappointed if things don't go our way. I think the last thing I want to say, you know,
no stone unturned, but we have lots of stones.
The last thing I want to say is that the conversation I had in the middle of this podcast episode was with Daniel Kibblesmith, who there's this great line in his Loki comic where he says something like, if the story doesn't start with Loki getting thrown out of somewhere, is it even a Loki story? And I just love that, like, Dan and I talked about that a little bit, but I love that Rishi Grant here calls them the god of outcasts, nothing more. Like, what is Loki if he's not being cast out somewhere? And I just thought that was really interesting, so... Yeah, and I mean, like, and the thing that Kid Loki says is whenever one of us dares to try to fix themselves, they're sent here to die. And then Rishi Grant goes, we are broken, all of us. So, like, that's the thing. Whenever a Loki tries to better themselves, they're pruned. So what does whoever's running the TVA have against an improved Loki? And I love your sort of prophecy angle thing that you're talking about. That feels right. Feels right to me. All right, anything else we want to chat about?
I think that covers it for now.
We did it. Proud of us. Anthony Brezikin, where can folks find your great work, such as your profile of Mark Bernardin?
Yeah, please check that out. It's a story that means a lot to me because it's about an entertainment writer who goes and does his own creative thing. A guy who tells the story of storytellers. As you and I both do, Joe, but became a storyteller himself. So His graphic novel is Adora in the Distance, and it has a really beautiful story about his daughter who has autism and how she inspired it and kind of helped him along to help him figure out who he was and trying to figure out, you know, who she was and imagine who she was inside. So that's going to be over at vanityfair.com, and I would appreciate any reads and shares.
All right, you can find me also on vanityfair.com. You follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This and Richard at Rylaws. So you can hear about his can dispatches. And we will be back next week at the finale. Our glorious purpose will continue. I'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.